Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Contemporary historians have searched for the historical Muhammad along many paths. In Muhammad and the Empires of Faith, The Making of the Prophet of Islam, published with University of California Press in 2020, Sean Anthony recommends employing non-Muslim and Muslim sources in tandem in order to view a fuller landscape of late antiquity. Anthony revisits the earliest Arabic materials, including the Quran, epigraphic and archaeological evidence, as well as contemporaneous non-Muslim sources and accounts preserved in the Sira Maghazi literature. These make up the four cardinal sources for his historical and philological method. Anthony's book both introduces a comprehensive portrait of the sources available for understanding Muhammad in his time period, as well as demonstrates how we can arrive at new insights through a lateral reading across the late antique period. In our conversation, we discuss the earliest evidence mentioning Muhammad, non-Muslim testimonies, narratives of Muhammad under the Umayyads, reinvestigating Muhammad as a merchant, the role of the scholarly tradition in recording biographical accounts, the Sira of Ibn Ishaq, how Abbasid imperial discourses shaped biographical narratives, literary conventions and cultural aesthetics of the late antique hagiographical writings, comparative readings across late antiquity, and future directions for historians. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. And now on to my conversation with Sean Anthony about Muhammad and the Empires of Faith, The Making of the Prophet of Islam. Welcome, Sean. Thanks for joining me on New Books in Islamic Studies. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about your new book, Muhammad and the Empires of Faith. We always start these conversations with a little bit of biographical information, and we spoke before about one of your previous books, but you've done a lot of work in between, and I imagine some of the narrative might be relevant for the work you're doing in this book. So could you tell us a little bit about your background, training, perhaps mentors or moments that shaped kind of the approaches you take, which is a big part of this book, stuff like that. How did you get interested in these materials, and where'd you come from as a scholar?
Yeah, like you said, there's many ways of telling that story, and I kind of wonder because I've been thinking a lot about memory and how memory feeds into history and all this other stuff. How, if I would compare the earlier account that I gave you, what would I say new? What am I going to say different? Who knows? yeah, I know exactly. Do a little source critical analysis. But in any case, I guess my first real encounter with this type of with Islam, thinking about historical Muhammad, all that other stuff. First time I ever thought about it was probably when I was in the 10th grade in high school. I had a history teacher that used to let the kids hang out in his classroom and play cards during a lunch hour. And I wasn't one of the cool kids that played cards. Usually I think it was euchre they played with him. But you could go around and shuffle to his library that he had there. And he had a Quran translated by Yusuf Ali there. and he had just talked about Islam when introducing the world religions and things like that. And I remember as a kid in the 10th grade, thinking about all the religions. this is going to be a little bit silly, but I was thinking about, well, you know, these religions, they make like pretty big claims for themselves. And I think we went through Judaism, Hinduism, Islam, Christianity, Judaism already. And I thought about them all and I thought, you know, which one, will I suffer the most, or will I be like most regretful if I get it wrong, right? If that religion is true and I don't believe, I thought, well, Hinduism and Buddhism, if I get it wrong, I'll just be reincarnated and I'll get another chance. Judaism, you know, the wrong parents. And so Islam and Christianity, though, they say that you're going to go to hell if you don't believe in them. Oof, which one's which? Which one should I choose? And so I started kind of being interested in that type of stuff. And so I think my actual academic experience happened when I was around that same age, around 15. I started reading historical books that I found at my local bookstores. And, you know, I was fascinated by both Christianity and Islam, but I think I was more taken in by Christianity and Christian theology. Initially, I thought I was going to become a minister. So I went to college to study kind of Christian theology, Christian history. But I continued to be fascinated by Islam. I kind of had a crisis of faith of sorts when I was in the middle of college and I wanted to do something else. I decided to do a study abroad. I chose to go to Cairo. And when I was in Cairo, instead of just flying back to the States from Cairo, I traveled to Istanbul. We kind of traveled from Cairo to Istanbul overland. And my brain was pretty just exploded. And I decided that the region, its history, and all that other stuff was something that was really appealing to me. And I also felt, the more that I studied, I had sort of a bit of a biblical studies background, interest, reading, kind of historical critical scholarship was very interesting to me when I was an undergrad. And I looked at Islam, I was like, well, you know, not so much has been done as has been done in the era, the kind of the arena of biblical studies. So it got me interested more in Islamic studies. I did an MA at the American University in Cairo, and then I went to do my PhD in Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations at the Oriental Institute at the University of Chicago. And Fred Donner, Wadal al-Qadi, Bahir Qutbuddin, and others were kind of major advisors of mine. I think for a very long time, ever since I was a teenager, I guess you can say now, it's just been a historical, philological, textual sandbox that I've enjoyed playing in. And it's enriched my life immensely. So I'm thankful to everyone that's helped me out.
Yeah, that's great. Now, you have a lot of great scholarship already, a few books out, translations. There's common through lines, I think. In this book, I haven't read everything of yours, Sean, but from what I have, it seems that in this book, you're being much more explicit about kind of a methodological type of through line, which I think is really valuable. But maybe you could kind of walk us through how this specific book emerged for you and how it kind of connects to some of those other projects you've been involved in.
I think really one of the reasons that I was inspired to write the book is what I think is important transformations that have been going on in the field. I think beginning probably in the late 90s, maybe you could date it earlier, and which I see as kind of a collapse of revisionist historiography, as people imagined the direction it was going to take following the publication in the 70s of things like Hegerism or The Sectarian Milieu by John Wansbrough. Hegerism, of course, written by Cronin and Cook. And I kind of wanted to write a book about what I thought could be the future of the historical Muhammad, work on early Islam that was, I hope, to be kind of a different take, a new take, a fresh take that will sort of reinvigorate it. I think Quranic studies right now has a lot of energy behind it for good reason. There's been very important manuscripts that have been discovered, studied, and are access to Muslim scholarship, Muslim philology, both classical, medieval, early modern, is much better, much stronger than it used to be. And I was just hoping to return to some of these older questions that a lot of people, I think, have stopped asking in terms of what can we know about the past? What can we know about the historical Muhammad? What role does historical methodology play? What does a kind of a post-Orientalist, post-revisionist approach to early Islamic history look like? I'm just trying to explore that and trying to find kind of my way through it, yet still maintain what I thought would be a very robust historiographical frame, a very robust kind of philological grounding, and just lay out some evidence that perhaps people that haven't been following the field very closely for the last decades or so might be surprised that it's out there. And some of the kind of interesting findings that I hope this kind of newer approach that I try to outline can provide.
Now, the kind of crux of the book, I guess, is this Sira Maghazi literature. Many people might be familiar with this already, but others might not. So can you tell us a little bit about this body of work? What does it look like? What does it tell us? How have contemporary historians understood them? What kind of challenges they pose for historians?
Yeah, sure. Well, what I kind of lay out is, well, let me put it this way. I see the book as kind of being divided into kind of three main sections. And the first section lays out what I think would be a type of mirror Muhammad, a kind of low resolution Muhammad that you get from three sources. That would be the epigraphy, the Quran itself, early non-Muslim accounts written in Syriac, Armenian, Greek, etc. And then I shift to kind of midway in the second part of the book and third parts of the book to this really big source, this really important source for the kind of cultural memory of Muslims and for early Arabic historiography called the Sira Maghazi literature. And the second part kind of asks, what's the origin of this literature? What's its purpose? And the third part kind of explores, like, how can a modern historian use it, interact with it? Or some strategies that we can use for reading it. So the Sira Maghazi literature. So what is it? Essentially, it's the epic of the Prophet Muhammad's life. And as kind of imagined and written down, probably just about a century after his death. I try to push that date a bit earlier and closer to his lifetime. And I essentially try to answer the question of who were the first people who wrote down the life of the Prophet Muhammad? Why does the genre look like it does today? How is it preserved? And all sorts of questions like this. The usual thing that you hear people say is that we don't really have any historical information about the Prophet Muhammad that's written down in literary sources in Arabic until this figure by the name of Ibn Hisham. And so over 200 years after the Prophet Muhammad, and Ibn Hisham very famously redacts and compiles an earlier author's work by the name of Ibn Ishaq, who dies in 767, and he is patronized by the Abbasid caliphs, who had just recently come into power in 750 as kind of the new caliphal dynasty. And often the kind of the old view is that Ibn Ishaq, as read by Ibn Hisham, is sort of a bottleneck, historiographical bottleneck, right? You can either accept what Ibn Ishaq says as historically true, and some of it kind of is a struggle to accept for modern critical historians, or you can kind of leave it to the side, right? You can't really work with it. And what I try to do is replace that kind of old trope and saying, actually, we have more than Ibn Ishaq. We have other authors that are available. We have earlier authors. I spent a great deal of time talking about the corpus of one of Ibn Ishaq's teachers, a man by the name of Ibn Shahab al-Zuhri. Ibn Ishaq, like I said just now, was very closely attached to the Abbasid court Abbasid, being the Abbasid caliphs who came to power in 750. Ibn Shihab was a scholar like Ibn Ishaq from Medina, but he was an Arab from Quraysh. And he was very closely attached to the court of the Umayyads, the caliphal dynasty that preceded the Abbasids and whom the Abbasids overturned in 750. So I'm pretty convinced that we actually have a large amount of material from this guy, Ibn Shihab Zuhri, and who wrote it down and recorded these traditions at the behest of the Umayyad Caliphate. Ibn Shihab Zuhri dies in 742, so we're a little bit earlier. And I also try to push it back even further that, and say that we very likely have a substantial corpus that even goes back to Ibn Shihab Zuhri's teacher. And this guy is someone by the name of Urwa ibn al-Zubayr, and he's very interesting, at least to me he is. And one of the reasons why he's very interesting is because he's a person that actually knew people that intimately knew the Prophet Muhammad himself. So Urwa ibn al-Zubayr is famously the nephew of Aisha, the Prophet Muhammad's wife, who is a very important source for traditions about his life and things like that. And he was also the son of a very prominent companion of the Prophet by the name of al-Zubayr. And he was the brother of someone that tried to topple unsuccessfully the Umayyad Caliphate as well. So he's a very interesting figure. And we have letters that are written, it seems, by him to a couple of Umayyad Caliphs that I think are very important sources for the life of Muhammad. So in other words, one of the things I'm trying to do is say, well, look, we have a lot more material from this genre than Ibn Ishaq alone, and that we need to pay attention to this material, and we should understand how it evolves chronologically over time, and that this material is mostly quoted in later sources, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't originate at an early date. And also, the other thing that I want to do is show how these sources are very much embedded in and affected by the political projects of their time. So it's very significant that Urwa, Zuhri, Ibn Ishaq, all these guys are writing as members of the political elite, of the kind of the hegemonic class of the early Islamic polity, whether it's held by the Umayyads or the Abbasids, and that their project is not just about writing the events of the Prophet Muhammad's life, but sort of explaining how the Prophet Muhammad is sort of the most central figure in history, how his message and his life gives birth to the most significant religion and the most significant community that carries this religion in human history, and how they are kind of the zenith of God's plan, his providential plan for kind of humanity that will eventually, of course, culminate in the end of time, the day of judgment, will all be judged as either wicked or righteous, etc. So there's a lot going on with these materials, and I tried to kind of flesh all that out and make it seem a more interesting enterprise, I think, and hopefully see the genre less easily dismissed as kind of, I don't know, as like I said, it's not so much the bottleneck that it once was. Hope that's good.
Yeah, that was a really detailed kind of bird's eye view of the whole book and some of the paths you take. I'm hoping we can zoom in here to a couple of things you've alluded to already. So you break the book down in these kind of three parts, as you mentioned earlier. The first, you kind of look at the earliest materials we have. And there you talk about some of these epigraphic type materials, non-Muslim testimonies talking about or alluding to Muhammad. Can you give us kind of a snapshot of these? I think you call them the cardinal sources that we have here. So what are the earliest materials that we have, and then what do they tell us?
Yeah. So the earliest material I think that we have is the Quran itself, and this is something we alluded to a little bit earlier. But the Quranic text, in my view, was codified at a very early date, probably in the reign of the third Caliph Ahmad. And one thing that's happened in recent decades is that we've been able to look at the earliest manuscripts of the Quran, both from kind of a codological perspective, so basically the perspective of the science of the book, being able to radiocarbon date the materials on which Quran fragments are written. And we're able to look at the kind of the language being used in the Quran and things like that. We have a very good sense that the Quran is a genuine kind of artifact of the early religiosity of the first Muslims, and was also an artifact of Muhammad's earliest preaching, right? So we have that. And one of the things that one might say is like, well, if it's so good and great, why don't we just use that? You know, that scripture, why don't we just use the Quran to write the history of the Prophet Muhammad? And the thing is, the Quran is not really too conducive for that. It doesn't contain a lot of narratives about the Prophet Muhammad's life or his companions, at least not narratives that are explicit. This is a little bit of a bad metaphor, but if any of your kind of listeners or any listeners familiar with the Psalms, I know the Psalms weren't really written by David, but imagine trying to rewrite the Book of Kings relying only on the Psalms, right? It would be almost impossible. It would be impossible. And in any case, the Psalms need to be read in light of what the Psalms say, not in light of what other texts say. And the same thing goes for the Quran. So the Quran doesn't necessarily give us a narrative about the Prophet Muhammad, but the Quran does tell us a lot about what the Prophet Muhammad and the early community believed, what types of religious practices were important to them, how they viewed their place amidst the monotheistic communities of the late antique Near East, etc. So there's a lot there. I don't want to undersell it. And the second source that I cite are kind of early non-Muslim accounts of the conquest. And then we also have kind of what they say, like, about these conquerors that are coming from the Arabian Peninsula. And very rarely do they make comments about, let's say, Muslim belief. Very rarely do they have a great deal to say. And a lot of the times they have kind of polemical or kind of distorted accounts of what the conquerors believe, say, or do, and things like that. But they are very good at talking about their own experience of the conquest, right? And there's a lot of things that what's interesting about them is that they know, for example, that there is a man named Muhammad that is the leader of these people, right? That they kind of revere him, that they regard him as a teacher, that he that he brings forth guidance, that he has a law that they adhere to, all sorts of things like that, that they can't eat pork. You know, so there's a lot of these sources. Most of them are written by churchmen or people that are somehow part of the church. The writing in Greek, writing in Syriac, writing in Armenian, those are the main sources. But they also give us a very kind of basic outline of who this individual is, to this individual named the Prophet Muhammad, right? Very rarely actually do they call him a prophet, interestingly enough. They recognize him as a lawgiver, as I said, as a teacher, but it's not really until after 690 that you see them being aware that Muslims regard him as a type of prophet, at least as far as the current evidence that we have is. But they do note that they pray, they make notes about kind of the Hajj, they make very very interesting kind of notes about kind of the public aspect of early Muslim religiosity. And about kind of Muhammad himself. Some of these are very early, like a lot of the earliest mention of the name of the Prophet Muhammad. We have at least two sources that probably date within a decade of his death. So that's really quite extraordinary, especially if you compare that to other historical founders of religion, like say Moses, and we don't have anything remotely historical that attests to Moses' existence, and let alone within a decade of his death. And the same things if you look at of Jesus of Nazareth, right? Jesus of Nazareth, we don't have anything like this in terms of a person writing about his existence within a decade of his death. In any case, after those non-Muslim sources, we have epigraphy, which is another place that's been really exploding in terms of the evidence that's available. So what is epigraphy? Epigraphy is when either officials, and they could be state officials or whoever, kind of write on buildings, have kind of official inscriptions that say something or other. Or you have individuals. Sometimes we call what the individuals write graffiti, but it's not like graffiti and like people have tagging walls and with spray paint or anything like that. It's just people kind of writing a lot of times prayers, invocations, asking for prayers later on. We also have epitaphs, so tombstones. As you kind of gather all of that type of material together, so things that Muslims were writing in, say, the first 100 years after 632, in Arabic, usually, and what they were writing and what they were saying about the Prophet Muhammad within those first 100 years. You had all sorts of interesting material. Of course, you have mentions of the Prophet Muhammad. You have mentions of him being an intercessor for people at the Day of Judgment. You have, mentions of him and asking God to kind of bless him and stuff like that. So we have a good deal of material that is written also, and I would say the register or using kind of the discourse of the Quran as a scripture as well. So these early inscriptions also give us important attestations in the way in which people are reading the Quran, internalizing the Quran, including it in their prayers and things like that, their prayers for forgiveness, their prayers for blessing. And they use Quranic, the Quranic idiom to do so. And this is something that you don't find, before Islam. You don't find what we recognize as the Quranic idiom and inscriptions from the 6th century, so the 500s. But as soon as you go to the 600s and the 7th century, and then, of course, the 800s, 700s, you get all of these inscriptions that kind of use the Quranic idiom as kind of the expression of their kind of religiosity and their faith and things like that. So all in all, if we look at like all these materials together, that gives us what I would say is a low resolution view of the Prophet Muhammad. And so the Quran, the non-Muslim source materials, the epigraphy, right? What we get is this idea of, there's a series of fundamental beliefs that the Prophet Muhammad and his community kind of espouse, right? This is sort of prophetic monotheism. Right. So the idea that there's one God, created the universe, and he communicates to humanity his will through people called prophets, and that when he communicates to these prophets, they're recorded down in scripture. Right. And that Arabic is a key kind of identity marker for these early Muslims and for that early message. That you have this embrace of the biblical and salvation history of the Jews and Christians. So Muhammad is mentioned in these inscriptions alongside Moses. Muhammad is mentioned alongside Jesus and others. We have this very clear belief in eschatology, that one day the world will end, and that one day humanity will be raised from the dead, and that us as individuals and as a collective, we will be judged. And if we are wicked, we will be punished with the torments of the inferno or hell. And if we are righteous, we will be blessed with the glories of paradise. And then also we have all these other things too. We have the emergence of a new kind of sacred calendar based on the Hijra. We get mentions of pilgrimage, ritual sacrifice. We have mention of the sacred struggle of jihad. It's a kind of the collective community action to kind of expand the borders and the dominion of the early Islamic polity of this Ummah of Muhammad. So there's a lot of material there. I got through a little bit of a laundry list there. But one of the things that I kind of want to try to communicate with is if once you look at all of these kind of tiny little dots and you zoom out and you look at the constellation of the whole, it's a really impressive body of evidence, especially when you consider like everything that I talked to you about just now, it appears within the first 100 years. Right. So I think it's a pretty extraordinary corpus that has been underappreciated up to this point.
Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, in the second chapter, you kind of walk us through kind of a case study too, and thinking about kind of revisiting these early sources and working with them against kind of the assumptions from later narratives of Muhammad, what kind of things we can come up with. So you focus on this idea of Muhammad as a merchant. So can you give us a snapshot of this? What do the sources tell us about this assumption, these earlier sources, and how might we understand his social activities after reinvestigation?
Yeah. So this was something that was really surprising to me when I started writing the book, because you often read, it's probably one of the first things that you learn about the Prophet Muhammad is that he was a trader. That's how he earns his living, right? Before, when he was living his life as an everyday individual, at least as everyday as a person like the Prophet Muhammad could possibly be, right? In historical memory. And it's a very early trip that you get in Western literature. But one thing I started noticing early on is it's not something that you often find in the early sources in Arabic, early kind of Arabic historiography. You don't often see them focusing on him being a trader as a way of earning his living. And I started to find that curious. And one of the reasons why I found that especially curious is that many of the earliest sources to mention the Prophet Muhammad by name state very explicitly that he was a trader. One of the earliest ones, probably written in the 660s, is that of the Armenian historian that we call Pseudo-Savios, because we don't really know who he is, and someone thought he was this guy named Savios. He's probably not, so we call him Pseudo-Savios. But anyway, we know he's very early. I say he's writing in the 660s. He calls the Prophet Muhammad a lawgiver. He gives a very accurate account of early kind of Muslim beliefs, at least accurate insofar as everything that he says about the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, you can find correlates in the Quran. And he says that the Prophet Muhammad was a traitor. So interesting. And then you have this another individual, another churchman by the name of Jacob of Edessa. He's called Jacob of Edessa because he was once Bishop of Edessa. He's writing in Syriac, and he has this nice kind of chronological table of the events that happened, within the last century or so. And he mentions the trade journeys of the Prophet Muhammad, and he gives a very interesting kind of trade circuit. He says that he traveled in Palestine, basically all throughout the Levant, in Syria and Phoenicia and things like that. But if you then look at the Sira material, and some of the Sira material is more or less contemporary with someone like Jacob of Edessa, you don't really have a lot of focus on the Prophet Muhammad as a traitor. A lot of people think that there is. And the reason why they think that he is because if you've ever learned anything about the Prophet Muhammad, you learn how important his first wife, Khadija, was. And Khadija was a very wealthy trading woman, merchant woman. long before kind of Islam came into the picture or Muhammad's prophetic call came into the picture. And the usual story about how Khadija and the Prophet Muhammad met one another is that Khadija had actually would not travel to trade herself. She would remain behind in Mecca. She was not kind of a well-traveled person as far as we know. And what she would do is she would hire out proxies. She would hire trustworthy men to kind of take her goods to market and trade and however she was trading to different locales on her behalf, right? And usually it's said that she that the Prophet Muhammad was very widely known as a trustworthy person, as a man of kind of rectitude and integrity, even before it's called prophecy. And that she kind of entrusted him with one of these trade journeys. She hired him out, all right? She hired him. But even though you have this mention of this kind of journey, this trade journey, that we only have one journey really that's mentioned in this literature. And we don't have a bunch of journeys mentioned that he goes on her behalf. Maybe there was, who knows? But the point is that the tradition doesn't list a bunch of journeys that he undertook. And there's also added to this another journey that supposedly the Prophet Muhammad undertook when he was a youth with his uncle. And the most famous version of the story has the Prophet Muhammad travel all the way up to Bostra in southern Syria, where a monk sees him and prophesies that he will be a prophet, right? But the earlier version of the story, he doesn't even leave the Arabian Peninsula because he's warned by a Jew in Taima that something bad will happen to the Prophet Muhammad if he leaves the Arabian Peninsula. In any case, you have at the most two trade journeys that the early tradition mentions. So the question is, well, how did the Prophet Muhammad earn his living? Well, if we read the Arabic historical tradition, it provides a very typological account. It says the Prophet Muhammad was a shepherd. So he was a shepherd like Moses in the land of Midian, right? It was a shepherd like Jesus, right? He was seen, the Prophet Muhammad is far more often portrayed in the Arabic historiographical tradition as a shepherd like in the kind of the typological model of the prophets of kind of the biblical tradition, right? David, Jesus, Moses, etc. Muhammad too was ostensibly a shepherd. And so one of the questions that I ask in the chapter is, well, was the Prophet Muhammad a traitor at all? Or is this just a confusion, exaggeration, or whatever? And if I explore all the different options, my view is that he was actually a traitor. I think that the Quranic text does testify to the fact that he was familiar with trade and trading and trade journeys, and that he had traveled beyond Mecca, beyond the Hejaz, definitely outside the borders of Arabia, very likely. And one of the reasons why I think that the early biographical traditions about his life de-emphasize this aspect of his livelihood or his life, why we don't have so many stories about it. There's one reason is that we don't have a lot of stories about the Prophet Muhammad from Mecca in general, relatively speaking, compared to Medina, because it happened a long time ago and many people died before they passed on the story. So there's that. But on the other hand, too, we get in the 8th century an emergence of a Christian polemic against the Prophet Muhammad that says that trading was the way in which he learned about the scriptures of the Jews and the Christians. And so the idea that the Prophet Muhammad was able to trade and became a worldly person and familiar with the kind of the traditions of Christians and Jews and things like that, it eventually becomes de-emphasized, I think, in the Islamic tradition as a way to prevent or guard against that polemic gaining sort of hold. That's one view of it. But I do think in general, he probably did trade. He probably was a trader. We have much better evidence for his people, Quraysh of Mecca, as being a trading people. That's a very common theme, both in the Quran and throughout the Syrian literature, kind of writ large. But like, yeah, and in general, and that chapter, I think I was just trying to take an old assumption, something that we take for granted, reinterrogate it, look at the kind of evidence anew, and sort of go a little bit into the sausage factory and see how things are actually made, like how certainties and facts that we think we know are maybe a bit more questionable than we thought. And then once you kind of question their foundations, to try to see if you can reconstruct it on a different basis.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting case study, and one that certainly would work well in classrooms in addition. So in the middle section of the book, you really take us through the development of this Syrian Maghazi literature, how it developed, and like you mentioned, the kind of political, social, historical context in which it's forming. So can you tell us a little bit about the early stages of this? What was the context in which this tradition started to develop? Who were the key actors producing it? And how did it fit into kind of the literary context of the time?
Okay. That's a big one. So
I trust you can do it, Sean.
Yeah. It's just like when you look at a watermelon, you're like, how am I going to eat this thing? Well, let's slice it up. I guess we'll start here. One of the central problems that we have is the question of, for the early Muslims, you have the Quran as a scripture. Okay, that's God's word. That's authoritative. Great. And then you can ask the next question, though, is, you know, the Prophet Muhammad was also a man. He wasn't just a book, right? And he wasn't just a person who delivered a book. Does his behavior, does his cultural context, do kind of his followers' cultural norms, do they carry any sort of authority with them as well, alongside the Quran and things like that? How much are things like Arabic, the cultural norms of Medina when he was kind of ruler in Medina from 622 to 632, how much of those carry forward for the community and things like that? How do you preserve that cultural memory? There, we have all these kind of larger questions about sort of the knowledge of the community outside of the Quran. And that knowledge of the community in Arabic was in general called ilm, right? Which just means knowledge. So the modern, in modern Arabic, you use it just for science. But it just means knowledge. But this type of ilm was really, I would say, kind of the unwritten aspects of the Prophet Muhammad's authority that were not embodied in the text of scripture, but was rather carried in the memories and the practices and the cultural norms of his followers. And after the conquest take place, of course, this is massively disruptive for the Medinan community, for the people, of course, who are being conquered. It's very disruptive for them too. But whenever you have a displacement of people and the spread of people across a mass geography, as anyone that's had the immigrant experience or the expat experience can testify, you have these questions of how are we going to preserve our cultural identity? How are we going to preserve our cultural norms? How are we going to preserve our language? And the way that this eventually comes to be answered is that we're going to master an oral tradition that tells us the normative aspects of the cultural milieu, the political practices, and of the Prophet Muhammad in the earliest community. But initially, there was a taboo of writing it down, of kind of codifying that down. And what happens as kind of generations pass is that people begin to die off, right? And the memories of the past die with them. Buildings like the Prophet's initial mosque are destroyed and rebuilt in order to accommodate a larger population of Muslims and things like that. And you sort of have this anxiety, I think, that the connection to the past is slipping away, slipping out of people's fingers. And you eventually have a kind of a cadre of scholars in multiple locations, mostly Medina and places like Kufa, but also other locations too in the empire, that dedicate most of their energies to sort of creating a bank of cultural historical memory, right, of this past. And eventually, the caliphal powers want to have that were at the time. They want to have this kind of bank of cultural memory written down. They want to have all these stories written down. And so, the attempt to take that cultural memory and write it down and put it into books gives birth to all sorts of different genres, right? The Hadith literature is one example. Tafsir literature, that is literature dedicated to exegeting and explaining the meaning of the Quran on the basis of like events and things like that. That's one genre. And one of the other major genres of this Sirah Mahazi literature that doesn't just take these anecdotes and collect them together, but rather tries to put them in a narrative frame, right? And when this narrative frame is created, there's all sorts of kind of interests that go into it. So if you kind of look at the Umayyads, you know, this kind of major caliphal dynasty that rules until 750, from 660s to 750, well, probably even earlier, but we won't get to that. Anyway, they rule until 750. They begin to take the first initiatives to write this stuff down, probably in the early 8th century. Definitely it's written down by 742. And this transforms the tradition from being primarily oral to being a hybrid tradition. So being both oral and written. And it remains both oral and written for many centuries thereafter. So it's a hybrid oral and written tradition, not exclusively either or. And of course, the question is that when you look at these early materials, the Sirah Mahazi literature, we don't know what the earliest texts look like because they're lost and what their entire content was, what their scope was. Our best idea is from Ibn Ishaq's book, His Kitab al-Mahazi, which he writes under the Abbasids. But he probably had started writing it well before he entered into Abbasid patronage too. So what we get really from these texts when we look at them in a political context and a cultural context is that these texts weren't just about the Prophet Muhammad. Like the Prophet Muhammad was like the centerpiece. It was like the crown jewel of the narrative, right? But it wasn't really what the genre was about only. What this really is a kind of a vast view of the entire expanse of human history, of God's divine providential ordering of human events that begins with creation and that culminates in the life of the Prophet Muhammad and the emergence of his community and continues until the era of the caliphate, which the authors are writing down. And so you have this idea of political community, providential destiny, all this stuff gets poured into these texts. Ibn Ishaq's text, I believe, was divided into kind of three main sections. The first section was called Al-Mubtada, or the Genesis, the beginning. And that went from broadly the creation of the universe and the creation of Adam, all the way to all the previous communities, the prophetic communities, before the Prophet Muhammad. So basically biblical history that you find in the Hebrew Bible and then also in the New Testament, and then the life of the Prophet Muhammad, and then after the life of the Prophet Muhammad, a history of the conquest and the emergence of the caliphate. So this kind of vast kind of epic history. And so what they are kind of really asking, put it another way, is how does the life and teaching of the Prophet Muhammad give rise to this imperial hegemony and this kind of cultural kind of hegemonic state that we have? How are we kind of the inheritors of prophethood? And how are we the vanguards of the Prophet Muhammad's prophetic message in particular? And it's kind of spread to all humanity and things like that. I think that's really kind of what's going on. So it's very much an elite-centered discourse that, interestingly enough, if you look at its history, kind of has a lot of grassroots from at least I should be careful with grassroots because we're talking about the grassroots among the elites, right? So it's not that the caliphs came to these scholars and they said, "Hey, Zuhri, hey, Ibn Ishaq, write this," right? What they did is the way that a lot of very kind of rich foundations and patronizing institutions do today, right? They say, "Here's this money, do your project," right? And it's not that the project would, of course, if the project would somehow be seditious or undermine caliph legitimacy, it would probably run into problems. But it was just very unlikely that it would undermine caliph legitimacy because these people were deeply embedded within the elites of their society, and they believed that the way that their society was organized and had come to form was more or less good, right? Sure, it needed to be tweaking, wasn't ideal in certain aspects, but they wouldn't fundamentally, for example, question the idea of whether or not the Islamic polity should have like hegemonic rule, right? They would never say to ourselves, you know, maybe the caliph fate shouldn't be with the Quraysh. Maybe, you know, we should give Egyptians back their territory and not rule over them and head back to Medina. Right? They wouldn't question the political realities of their time so fundamentally, right? What they want to do is create a story that showed how God had chosen the Prophet Muhammad, and through choosing the Prophet Muhammad, chose his community and was kind of achieving something of cosmic and historical significance through them, through his providence.
Now, we should note that you do this all in great detail with all sorts of tidbits from texts probably most listeners will never see in their life. But just for the sake of time, I'm not going to get into the weeds in these. The last section of the book, you kind of tie these social historical context into kind of a broader snapshot in the sense of thinking about the creation of these materials within the late antique period and kind of rhetoric of empire in the construction of this literature. So can you talk a little bit about, because I think this is one of the key mythological concerns you're interested in, is how do the kind of imperial discourses shape the narratives of these texts, and then how does this approach where you take a kind of comparative look across late antiquity, how does that help us understand Muslim writings in this period?
Yeah, so if we, everything that we said, you know, about this literature as being like, you know, historical, epic, cosmic, and all other stuff, this doesn't happen in a vacuum, right? I think this is one of the problems with Islamic studies in general is that we've gotten pretty good. This is even true, I think, for people that are more interested in the philological aspect of the Arabic tradition, of reading all of these texts within the silo of the Islamic tradition, right? It's like, oh, this hadith was written very early on and recorded in this text, and then it was subsequently canonized when al-Bukhari included in his hadith this kind of authoritative collection of the traditions from the Prophet Muhammad. And then we have these great commentary traditions of like Ibn Hajar and Fath al-Bari that represents another development. So we kind of have this, I call a kind of a vertical reading strategy. You follow kind of the history of a text and its interpretation within the Islamic tradition. And what kind of the perspective of late antiquity does, and what I hope I was able to do, is provide a more lateral perspective. So instead of thinking about its reception history with inside of the Islamic tradition, thinking about how it is responding to its environment and the literary genres that it was surrounded with. So one of the things that's interesting about the writing of the Sira Mahazi literature is I think this is really the birth of historical writing and historiography in the Arabic language writ large, and in the Rabo Islamic tradition as well. And part of these, part of the mission of these texts, and this is very explicitly stated by some of the early scholars, is they have to compete with the epic literature of the surrounding cultures that they encountered when they're spreading the Islamic polity, right? This includes the epic literature about kings that you get with Sassanid Persia, right, the pre-Islamic dynasty of Iran. This includes Greek literature. This includes stories about Alexander the Great. This includes biblical literature. And this includes a very popular genre that I think is unjustly neglected by students of early Islam in late antiquity called hagiography, right? Stories about holy people. And so one of the things that I think we need to pay attention to and what I try to explore in those chapters is the way in which these genres are kind of making claims about the early Islamic polity and its hegemony among its rivals, right? So what makes the early Islamic polity and the caliphate different from, say, the Byzantine Empire or the Eastern Roman Empire, right? What remains of the Roman Empire? What makes it different from the Sassanid Empire of Iran that preceded the rise of the caliphate? So that, so this genre in some ways answers these questions. The other thing too is that this genre is in many ways, the Sira Mahazi literature is in many ways beholden to the aesthetic demands and the aesthetic conventions of a lot of these genres as well. So I try to explore the way in which late antique hagiography influenced the picture and portrait of the Prophet Muhammad that we get in a lot of this early literature, right? Because the hagiography in many ways creates cultural expectations of what does a holy person look like? What does a holy person do? What's a holy person's religious experience look like? How does a holy person's behavior and comportment affect our religiosity? What's their religiosity teach us about how one interacts with God and angels and so on and so forth? All of these kind of expectations of this literature finds an imprint in the early stories in the Sira Mahazi literature as well. As many of us, like this, the example I always give to my students is that of a rom-com or kind of just typical romantic movie, right? We always know when we go into a romantic movie, like the typical trope is that you have two opposites that are attracted to one another. They have this amazing relationship, and then eventually they have an argument. They split, right? And then it seems like they're not going to come back together. But then by the end of the movie, they come back together, and everybody's happy, and the credits roll, right? It's like the Harry Met Sally type model, or you know, any billion other type movies like this. That's what we expect from the movie. That's what it looks like, right? You the same thing with like hero movies. We just expect they have an origin story, and then they first try out their powers, and they got to learn the moral lessons and moral consequences of their powers. Same thing works with hagiography, and these kind of genre conventions and genre expectations. I think if we read the Sira Mahazi literature laterally, right, in light of hagiographic literature written Syriac and Greek and so on and so forth, that's contemporary with it being with these texts, then we can kind of learn a lot about the genre as well.
So you kind of give us an example here with another figure from this time period, and I don't even know how to say this. Is it Kedmon?
Yeah, Kedmon. Yeah.
Okay, Kedmon. So you kind of do a comparative reading of Muhammad with this figure Kedmon. So can you tell us about the story, where it would have been found, and why narratives of Muhammad follow these kind of common literary conventions found in the story of Kedmon?
Yeah. So it's a really interesting story, right? So for listeners that don't know, It's basically Kedmon's story is about the earliest person to kind of compose hymns in the ancestor language of English, basically. And his story is recorded in the Venerable Bede's history of the English people, or ecclesiastical history of the English people. And Bede completes his work, I think, in 731. So it's pretty much a contemporary with Ibn Ishaq, a little bit older contemporary with Ibn Ishaq and Ibn Shihab al-Zuhri, actually, too. And one of the things that's very interesting about the story of Kedmon is that he receives his ability to compose these beautiful hymns miraculously. Okay. And as it starts out, he's an unlettered, unsophisticated man, and he falls asleep, and he has a vision. He has an angelic kind of visitor, and the angelic visitor tells him to sing, and he responds, "I cannot sing," and then he tells him to sing again. He says, "I cannot sing," and then he tells him, "You have to sing," and then he has this gift to kind of sing of the glories of God and his creation in this miraculously eloquent way. And the head abbess of the monastery, St. Hilda, she takes him to some scholars and sees whether or not what he's like singing about is correct and all sort of stuff, and they confirm it and blah, blah, blah. It's an extraordinary story, and one of the things that makes it even more extraordinary is that that's the exact thing that happens to the Prophet Muhammad in his early life, right? He falls asleep, and he is approached by an angel, but instead of being told to sing, he's told to read or recite, and he says, "I can't," then he's told to recite again, he says, "I can't," and then he says, "Recite in the name of your Lord," and then he acquires this miraculous ability to recite this this divine book, this miraculously eloquent Quran. And first he has his doubts, and then he goes to his wife Khadija, who consults with a scholar by the name of Warqa ibn Nawfal, a Christian. He's said either to be learned in the Hebrew or Syriac scriptures, depending on the version of the story that you read. And it's a puzzle, because the question is, well, how in the world do these two stories have so much in common, right? So one was written, in Northumbria, and one was written in, well, Medina or Iraq. How in the world could they be so similar? They're separated from thousands of miles, but they appear simultaneously in the historical record at the exact same time. And so I kind of explore two options of how this might be. And I kind of go between the two options. I don't remember if I came down on either side of one in the book now, because I've changed my mind so many times. But one option I have is, well, maybe the story of Muhammad is so early, it's a lot earlier than our recorded versions of it, that somehow it reached Bede. It reached, Bede writing his, and he kind of used the story of Muhammad to make, for his, as a model or archetype for Kedmon. But it would be very strange for Bede, because Bede doesn't even know who Muhammad is. He never mentions Muhammad in any of his texts. He doesn't even know. He knows that the Saracens exist. He knows about the Islamic conquest, but he doesn't really seem to know that they have a religion or anything like that. So that seems not very likely. But so I explore that as an option, and I think about some scenarios where that might have occurred. And then another scenario that I talk about is that perhaps Bede and Zuhri ibn Ishaq, the people who told this story, are relying upon a common hagiographical archetype. That is, maybe this type of story was told about many different people. And I give some examples of other people whom such a story was told about. One of my favorite examples is the story of how Romanos, the Melodist, an early Byzantine hymnist from Hems or Emesa, who lived long before the Prophet Muhammad did, or Kedmon for that matter, how kind of his story is very similar to both of these stories. But the point of kind of exploring all the stories, their similarities and things like that at the end, what I want the main takeaway to be, is to show how the early Sira Malhazi literature interacted with and drew from a lot of the literary expectations, conventions, tropes, topoi of the hagiographical literature of late antiquity, and how it was more or less entering into the fray and building this image of the Prophet Muhammad as not only a type of ideal holy person, but rather as the archetype of a holy person, and how this kind of typological aspect of historical writing and historical storytelling is very important for understanding why the stories that we have today survive and what role they played for their initial audiences, right? What they're telling us is, in essence, not merely kind of the raw facts, but rather they're telling us that the Prophet Muhammad is the archetype, is kind of the culmination of who a holy person is and who a prophet is. And he kind of embodies and fulfills all of these tropes and typologies in his life story and in his person.
Well, it's a really great book, Sean. I think not only for people that are working on kind of this particular time period or the historical Muhammad in general, but I think it would work, you know, in methodologically in other contexts as well. So I hope people will check it out. I can't imagine that you're sitting around doing nothing. So what types of things are you working on now? What kind of things can we expect from you down the road?
Yeah. So right now I'm trying to put the finishing touches on. So I did a translation and edition of a biography of Omar ibn Abdulaziz, this early Umayyad caliph that is considered to be the fifth rightly guided caliph. He's usually what he's remembered as. So I took his earliest biography, I re-edited the Arabic text, and I retranslated it. So I'm editing that now. And I'm also doing the finishing touches on a project I did with my colleague, Stephen Shoemaker, where I translated the Christian Arabic version. He translated the Georgian version of an eyewitness account of the Persian conquest of Jerusalem that happened right before the Islamic conquest of Jerusalem. And I don't know when it comes to, I don't know what I'm going to do for my next monograph. I got a lot of encyclopedia articles and other articles that I've been wrangled into, but we'll see what that kind of next development is. I'm kind of reeling from this book right now, but I'm trying to tie up those big projects.
Great. Well, good luck, Sean. And thanks again for making the time to talk about this book.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Sean Anthony about Muhammad and the Empires of Faith, The Making of the Prophet of Islam, published with University of California Press in 2020. And thanks again for listening to another podcast on new books and Islamic studies.